The match. Yes, there we are. 1 Kings 19. And I don't want to begin with an apology. I got told off by Brother Horn once for starting a discourse with an apology. So I'm not going to say I'm sorry, but I am really, that I've come for the first discourse with a non-spiritual discourse. I have to remember that since 1914, judgment passed over from the church to the world of mankind. And so the affairs of the world of mankind are coming more and more in focus. And sometimes we have to drop off and have a look at what is happening in that world if we are to understand what is going on. And this is really the nature and the history of anarchism. I possibly won't see a lot of it myself, I don't know, it depends on when the Lord calls me away and when it comes on a worldwide basis, but I do believe that all of the brethren alive at that time were going to get very, very much acquainted with this business of anarchism on a very broad scale, particularly in relationship to biblical prophecy. Of course, it's not purely a political exercise, but in order to explain what anarchy is, I thought I would drop off from examining spiritual things and look at what is happening in the world that the prophecies are taking hold of and dragging into the truth scene. That's what's happening. They're being brought into the picture, very, very forcibly indeed. Whether they're aware of it or whether they're not, they're going to fulfill prophecy. The world itself and all its various secular movements are being dragged into the center of stage and being required by God to fulfill the prophecies that he's made. Therefore, as Bible students, we need to understand these things in some depth if we are to understand what the prophecies are actually saying. Anarchy, of course, the fire in symbol of the Bible. And we want to comprehend the what the relevant prophecies are telling us, and that is my reason, oblique excuse, oblique apology for coming to you with this more or less political history. The first part is almost pure politics to explain the situation. The second part relates it to biblical prophecy. So I hope you'll bear with me, and I sincerely have desperately hard tried in the second discourse to make up for that. I know you don't come here for political lessons, you come here for spiritual uplift and for fellowship and so forth. But remember Pastor Russell when he wrote volume 4. There's an awful lot in there that isn't spiritual. An awful lot in there that is not spiritual. It's the price of silver and the price of gold. That sort of thing. What does the word anarchy mean? Oh, yes, thank you. What does the word anarchy mean? Well, basically, it means, and this is an analysis, it is a political analysis. It means an absence of government. A political situation where there is no supreme power, no centrally positioned rulership, whatever the reason for that might be. Try and get hold of that central thought. It is only, anarchy is only a situation in a population without a central government. That is anarchy. There is a popular conception of anarchy as a state of lawless confusion and unbridled social chaos. It's a common view. And this popular conception of anarchy as being an unbridled lawlessness is a valid one. It is supported by the very origin of the word. It has a linguistic, what we call etymological link, the word itself. It comes from a very primitive Aryan word that's now gone out of use, but that moved into the Greek tongue for the word brain, and they adopted it for their word brain, and it was archos, as the Greeks would have it. And it means head, leader, or brain. Now, if we add the Greek negative prefix, which is an, it gives us anarchos, or headlessness, or brainlessness, or leaderlessness. So anarchos, as opposed to archos, implies a state of brainlessness, a state of leaderlessness. And it is true that a state of confusion and mayhem adequately fits this view of anarchy. So we say, oh, it was anarchy, you know. It's people jumbled up in confusion and no order and so forth. It is, however, and this is the burden of what I have to say today, a popular misconception of anarchy to say that there's nothing more to anarchy than mindless mayhem. Biggest mistake you could ever make. Because such a view entirely ignores the most interesting and significant expression of this thing that we call anarchism, which is going to play such a great big part in the fulfillment of the divine plan of the ages, which is why I'm bringing it to you today. It's going to play a big part. You see, there is a form of anarchism which is founded on a carefully reasoned out, long-held political theory that all organized government, anywhere, anytime, is both evil and totally unnecessary. And that therefore a liberty which is compatible with social virtue should be granted to all individuals who are prepared to adhere to that standard of social virtue. Now, this form of anarchy has been considered by very able social thinkers and activists, some of the deepest thinkers of all time, but thought along this line certainly over the past 2,500 years. It's not a new thing, this business of anarchy. To be recognized as such is a different thing. And an anarchic way of life, which is very, very far away from that mindless mayhem that we usually associate with it, has been set forward by a number of these people as the ideal state for mankind to live in. And all other social developments should be headed for that position of eventually what they call utopian, not mindless, utopian anarchy. Take, for instance, Samuel Taylor Coleridge, that great poet. Unfortunately, he got mixed up, innocently I believe, with taking laudanum as a drug, and his mind went. You remember he wrote the rhyme of the Ancient Mariner? The Ancient Mariner who saw the wedding guest and stoppeth one in three, one of three, stoppeth one of three, and all this story about the albatross comes out. This was the man. In the year 1794, he planned with another great poet, Robert Southey, and others, to found what they called a pantisocracy on the banks of the Susquehanna River in Pennsylvania, USA. Pantisocracy. But you haven't heard of that one, have you? No? Panto universal. Iso equal. Kratia rule. Panto, iso, kratia, universal, equal rule. Anarchy. A pure utopian anarchic system of living. A non-hierarchic social structure in which every person would have and live by liberty of conscience as the only rule. Sounds beautiful. You've got to remember that these early anarchists who thought along these lines were high-minded, idealistic peoples. It's clear that anarchy, therefore, appears in various forms, and here we do a little bit more analysis. And it comes from various causes. Firstly, there is social chaos caused by a breakdown of law and order under a single government. So if you have a single government in this country and suddenly some great issue comes up and people start throwing stones all over the country, you can have anarchy break out with a single government. Another form is a political chaos where you have competing governments in a country trying to rule the country, and there's so many of them chipping in that nobody can rule effectively. Anarchy. Between the wars, we nearly came to this in France, they had about 4 or 5 governments a year, and everybody was afraid that it was going to break down into anarchy. Because they weren't there long enough to be able to legislate and then put the legislation through. Therefore, there was no legislation until de Gaulle stood up and said, Vive la France! And this all came together under the one ruler. That's what happened. So that's the first and the second. The third is interesting. It is the discarding of any form of central government and replace that by one of two alternatives. Now, if you can understand this next bit, you will understand much of what Brother Johnson writes, and if you don't, you won't. Firstly, there is a social administration by independent syndicates, such as trade union associations. Let them take over and do the rule. because each syndicate is working in its own sphere, and the whole of the country is in a lot of interest spheres. If each one had its own syndicate and ruled their own little place by election, you would have a form of anarchy which we call syndicate anarchy or anarcho-syndicalism. Brother Johnson writes about this, and few of the brethren understand what he's talking about when he refers to anarcho-syndicalism, but he forecasts that it is going to come as part of anti-typical Hazael and Ben-Hadad. Yes. Try not to spend too much time thinking of the anti-type. Think of what these separate issues are and the divisions that there are in this analysis, and then when it happens, you can always refer back and say, oh, well, that is that, and that is that. So that is anarcho-syndicalism. And then there is the pure anarchism, what we call utopian anarchism, total freedom of each and every individual in an agreed, universally benign relationship, where everybody is given their freedom. More on this later. Now this, one form or another of these anarchic ways of life is still being recommended by some as the only viable alternative to the evils of corrupt, tyrannical governments. And all over the world they're crying out about these, on the one hand, and to the crumbling efficacy of many forms of democratic government that we see in the other countries. In every country there is a criticism of the very governmental system itself. So if you took one form, put it in another country, that form, put it in another country, it's becoming clear that it wouldn't be long before they would be hitting the roof about the form of government that they have. Therefore, it is not the form of government which is at fault, say the anarchists, it is government itself. That is their point. It's important to be clear on one particular matter. Anarchism as a political theory is absolutely unique. This is another section, as it were. You know, when you cut something in a section, it reveals certain strata. You cut it elsewhere and you find there's an entirely different pattern comes out. This is what we're doing. Between anarchism and all other forms of political thought, there is, and always has been, and always will be, a complete divergence of views. You get every other school of political thought, and from one standpoint they can be placed in one camp, and the anarchists in another. We're going to look at that. Right up until the 19th century, that divergence was between two classes in society. On the one hand you had the radicals, and on the other hand you had the conservatives. All right, what are radicals and what are conservatives? Let's define our terms. Radicals are those who want fundamental reform to the existing system, whatever it is. So if you're in Russia under the communists and you want a fundamental reform, you're a radical. If you're in this country and you're in under a conservative government and you want reform, you are a radical. Just because you want a total reform. Whereas the conservatives are those who want the things to stay the way that they are. Radicals, conservatives. Now in this instance, the radicals, under the rulers of those days in the 18th century, 19th century, had the interests of the peasant class at heart, the lower classes. And they were working for a revolution, either peaceful or otherwise, some work one way, some another. They were working for a revolution which would rid these peasants of their masters, the kings, the clergy, the aristocracy, and church and state. Now you're beginning to get down to volume 4 of Pastor Russell, you see. While the conservatives, who stood for the interests of the existing rulers, kings, clergy, aristocracy, tried to keep it all quiet and keep things going the way that they were. However, we're looking now at the effect of the coming of the Industrial Revolution working through the 19th century. It started late in the 18th century, in the 1700s. We see coming onto the scene machines and factory life. We see a completely changed culture in this, all of the civilized world that used these machines. We see new political groupings appearing, arising out of the newly emerging interests of the factory workers, and just as it began to get going and established, Pastor Russell comes on the scene and the harvest. That is linking it into our chronology. So we had, for the first time in history, We had a whole social class of factory workers. We had a whole social class of factory owners. We had the people with the money that flooded those factories, we call them capitalists, came onto the scene as a class. We had industrial lawyers come on the scene as a class. And these various different groupings wanted their interests representing, and they began to band together. And in this new environment that came at that time, just before Pastor Russell's day, the radicals themselves were split. They were no longer merely fighting the battle of the peasant class. They were forced to make a change, a choice. Now then, these very purist anarchists, believing, as I said, that all forms of government are evil, said that if these factories went ahead, they would not free the people but further enslave them, and merely give them either more or alternative rulers for the ones they'd already got. And aren't they right? Yes, they're right. And so they, in those days, viewed the Industrial Revolution as a great evil, and they tried to smash up the machines. Have you heard of the Luddites? You're looking at one of the anarchic outbursts there. And what did the Conservatives do? Bang them all off to Australia, the ones that they left alive. The anarchists believed that if this went on under the Industrial Revolution, the peasant class would be drawn away from this urgent requirement, their historic purpose, to throw off their rulers. And in this, they found that they were in a totally different scene after the new conditions of the Industrial Revolution had broken out. Some of the radicals, seeing this change come onto the scene, didn't want to get rid of all the factories. They said, no, let us keep the factories and let us use them. Let us take them over and use them. So they reasoned that these new factory owners would first of all have to bring in the peasants from the land to run the factories. They couldn't run the factories until they'd been educated, and so the first step was to educate the peasants. And this other branch of anarchists said, now then, if they educate the peasants to run the factories, we can then start talking to those educated peasants about such things as radical political organization, radical social change, radical economics, because we'll be talking to an educated peasant. The educated peasant or factory worker is Karl Marx's proletariat. Ever heard the term proletariat? Most people say, oh, it's just the everybody's. It isn't. It is the educated peasant. Karl Marx wanted to use the proletariat to produce his revolution. He despised the peasants, says you can never do anything with them, you can't even teach them. You see, this new class in this now changed world, for the first time, would be gathered together near to the factories, not scattered all over the countryside, working all the hours that came where they couldn't be reached to be educated. And in this situation, those who were grouped around the factories, and you know the Industrial Revolution, you see all the Industrial Revolution towns in this country? They're all houses packed together around the factories, aren't they? Well, you see Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels and people like that who wanted to change the world by this new revolution to communism said, yes, now we've got them. We call a meeting there, we can get hundreds. You call a meeting in the country, you might get three or four. We could get a bit of time off and the bus wasn't looking. See the difference? So most of these radical thinkers saw this new class of factory workers as a potentially powerful revolutionary force with newly acquired skills that the peasants before had not had. They would be then capable of overthrowing the state. Not only overthrowing it, which is only the first step, but then, because they were educated in radical politics and radical economics, they would be able to replace that government with a new one. That was a critical factor. And they knew the peasants would never be able to do that. And that system that they wanted to replace the old system with was the communism of Karl Marx and this man Friedrich Engels. Both came from the Germany area. Friedrich Engels had a factory in Manchester, and eventually went down with Karl Marx and studied using the British Library in London to do most of their work. Now this was a thing they knew which the uneducated peasant class couldn't do. And so when you look at all the radicals that there were at that time, most of them went with Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels. And then later, when they went, and Lenin and Trotsky and people like that came, the bulk of the radicals went with them, because they saw there were rich pickings in this new factory system once they'd thrown the old bosses off and taken over. And very few followed that other group represented in Pierre-Joseph Proudhon, one of the fundamental thinkers of anarchy, and Mikhail Bakunin. You'll have read his name in a recent magazine. This puts him into the picture. The magazine doesn't, this helps. Those two at the time were the leading protagonists of utopian anarchism. Not this new body of anarchists that wanted to go and take the factories over and institute communism. And so we see here that the anarchists were sidelined as a direct result of the Industrial Revolution. And so frustrated were they that they couldn't get a political hearing that they developed a new form of propaganda. They would assassinate a famous figure. And in all the hullabaloo that came and people were saying why, they would have a platform for their political doctrine. Or they would go into a crowded marketplace and throw a bomb. And in all the hullabaloo that followed, they would be taken and put on a platform in front of the people and charged with murder and mayhem and all the rest of it. And they said, yes, do that. And then, when I give you an answer to your questions, I will be able to tell you about anarchy. That's why they did it. That's why the anarchists are associated with bombs. It is a form of propaganda. Anyway, later in the 19th century, we see a further split. Marxist communism had no appeal for the more democratic countries, like Britain especially, and a disagreement arose on the way in which a radically reformed state after a revolution should be organized. Now, Britain was still very religious. You remember, this is where the British and Foreign Bible Society had been not very long beforehand. Britain was still heavily influenced by the teachings of John Wesley. Britain was being pounded with the scriptures, as it were, and given spirituality to feed on by none other than Ira D. Sankey and Dwight L. Moody. Do you remember the Moody and Sankey? My immediate forebears to them, it was a household name. Everybody sang Moody and Sankey hymns, the great preachers around this country. And you see this fended off atheistic communism. And Keir Hardie, who was the founder of the British Labour Party, the modern labour movement in the whole of Europe, the socialistic movement, he was the founder of these things, one of the founder members. And he stated clearly, and in writing, and I have his writings at home, that there is no room in Britain for communism as it is preached by Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels. And in this way we saw Europe being divided into its two main radical political groupings, the Communist Party on the one side, anti-typical Hazel, and on the other side, Democratic Socialists, anti-typical Jehiel. Can you see how it came about in history? Brother Johnson's writings now put into a political perspective. And in the background, again, fuming with their frustration, we see the anarchists. Now, the hardline anarchists, the ones that had been pushed to one side, were very strong in Russia, because in Russia, the vast acres that they have there, they had many, many peasants. They hadn't been able to industrialize except in the west of Russia. Now, they'd lost the main body of radical support, and they were still looking to the peasant classes to achieve their revolution, and they clung in a very determined way to their principles. And if you've ever heard of the nihilists, these were the young people, the young radicals coming forward, who saw this move with the peasants, looked at the factory system, didn't like what they saw, and they were skeptical about everything. They believed in nothing. They wouldn't trust anything. That's why they call it nihilist, and the word nihil is either Greek or Latin, I can't remember which, for nothing. They believe in nothing. Nihilist. That's where the name comes from. At this stage, some of the pure anarchists said, we're never going to get anywhere this way. Let us get into the factories, try to win over these new syndicates, these new trade union congress people, to our way of thinking, and instead of pushing communism, state control, let us push anarchism, which gives everybody the freedom. Can you see control and freedom, the two differences? state control through communism or freedom. That was the difference between the communists and the anarchists. And if we can do that, they say, we shall have developed this, what Brother Johnson calls, anarcho-syndicalism, which has a specific type in the scriptures, if you read Brother Johnson, with understanding. So since then, if you can think of these anarchists, they're not only fighting, they're fighting on a number of different fronts. Not only against the old enemy, the alliance of church and state, not only against the aristocracies that are now weakened by the incoming capitalists. Lovely to break down and show you how that happened and what the effect was, and which explains much of what you're reading in your newspapers today, this alliance between the old aristocracies, like Earl Spencer, and the incoming capitalists. And the marriage of those changed the nature of our society, changed the principle, changed the culture. We're unaware of it. It filtered through. But here are the anarchists fighting against them, but now they're also fighting against the organized radicals, because the communists merely gave them new masters, so they oppose the communists. The democratic socialists merged with the capitalists. Brother Johnson tells you this, and there is a type of in the scriptures which gives us an indication that the democratic socialists will become very friendly with the capitalists every time when they're threatened by the anarchists or the communists. And this is in the news. So the anarchists are fighting against all of those. The Communist Party, you won't know this very likely, but there was a great organization which started all this off. It was called the Industrial Workers of the World. And on every street corner in London over certain years, you would find the communists standing there, Harry Pollitt and all those other old ones. Workers of the world, unite! You've got nothing to lose but your chains. And this was the call that went out. So what is it that is under this universal difference between the anarchist and all the other parties? It's an interesting one to Bible students. What is it that defines this fire of 1 Kings 19, 11 and 12 from all other movements? The answer is an ethical, it is almost a religious one. And you may, and I hope you are, surprised. It is the belief by the anarchist that mankind was created good, and that he is by nature good. And if he's only given an opportunity and left to his own devices, that good within him will rise naturally to the surface and will control his actions as an individual without the need for any duress from any hierarchic party. So he believes that man was created good. Have you ever heard that before? Yes. He's got part of the truth there, you see. Now he believes when the good rulers see this, developing, re-educated, told to stand by and forced to stand by and see what good there is arising out of a situation where they are no longer rulers, to give them an education. And all society must cooperate in protecting this liberty of the individual by ensuring that rulership is no longer an option in society. Man, therefore, according to the anarchistic theory, was not only made good, with which the Bible agrees, but the anarchist said he is, even in his present state, self-perfectible, with which the Bible disagrees. And you see the difference. So the anarchist says that all forms of government will merely interrupt or inhibit or corrupt and eventually destroy this process of becoming perfect. Now then, every other view of society is in opposition to this view, and we must include the truth itself is in opposition to this view, because every other one is based on the belief that man is by nature evil. Where most of them have got it wrong is that they say man was originally evil and always has been. So he disagrees with the Bible in that respect, but he does agree, and it's only because they can't see the perfect creation and the fall. It's as simple as that. And so all others believe that man must be governed for his own protection, and that is the fundamental difference between the anarchist than everybody else. In all this, can you see how close they come to the truth? There are gnats whiskered away in some ways from the truth. All others, be they monarchy orientated, aristocracy, capitalist, state control orientated, if they're heredity, if they're elected, formed by delegates from federated groups like the old USSR after the 17 revolution in 1921 and 2. Every one of them, except the anarchists, rely for peace, prosperity and social culture on a principle of a population controlled by a strong central government. Now, one exception is recognizable by that touchstone of anarchic thought that all forms of government are inherently evil. They're not bad people just trying to try and create mayhem. Oh no. They just believe that government is evil. Judging by all the governments we see around in the world today, are they very far out? No. This explains, you see, why all governments fear anarchism of any kind, and in spite of all their other enmities, they will combine forces and, as it were, conspire, breathe together on this particular issue, as they did in Spain. I'll explain this later. Brother Johnson shows this from prophecy that it is so. Here's an interesting one. In Russia, middle 19th centuries, as I said earlier, the anarchists had been trying to foment a peasants' revolt to liberate the people from the Tsarist regime and the religious rulers. They believed this would free the peasants to develop their land and their way of life along those agrarian agricultural principles which underlie anarchist cultural thinking. And in 1917, when that revolution came, in which the anarchists were prime movers, after 1917, when the communists began to take over, the anarchists were totally opposed to this, totally opposed to the plans of Lenin and Trotsky and all these others, following the Marxist doctrine, who introduced a rigid form of rulership by a revolutionary state government. Oh, they hated that. Now, in the wake of the Russian Revolution in 1917, there was 4 years until 1921 of turbulent years of factional infighting and intrigue in that country. The other nations all around about, and you can read your books, history books, it's absolutely replete with this, were looking on and worrying in case that trouble there spread into the other countries. In just the same way as they were when the French Revolution was on. They were desperately afraid that it might spread into the other countries. And then in 1921, the communist spokesman, Leon Trotsky, was put to death with a pickaxe later by one of his political enemies, trying to get acceptance and recognition of this new revolutionary state in order that they could get trade agreements going and get some economy going in Russia, made a public announcement to all the nations of the world that the new revolutionary Russian state government was now stable and secure, so you could start your trade agreements with that government, because, he said, at last the Soviet government, this new system they've got going, with an iron broom has rid Russia of anarchism. If you can understand that statement, you've got the key to the whole situation. Anarchism was the great enemy, the enemy of every state. When you understand this, you begin to understand the power that is facing the world of mankind, that is going to grind Satan's system into dust. To do that, it's got to have an awful lot of power. Opening up some of this power. To summarize, the underlying divergence of view between anarchism and all forms of political theory lies in the nature of mankind. Is mankind by nature good? And although damaged by previous and current destructive governments and rulerships, is that human nature perfectible, recoverable, without rigid laws? And if such rigid laws exist, should they be broken for the good of all? The anarchist says yes. That's why they do as they do. You should read the lives of people like Emma Goldman, the great American revolutionary anarchist. what they're trying to do is good. The means they try to do it, they're hopeless. Or, on the other hand, is man by nature evil and are governments necessary to impose and enforce laws in order to gain and maintain stability, peace, and prosperity for all? Every other one, other than the anarchist, says yes. Anarchism itself may be as old as post-diluvial man. I don't know anything about before the flood, but after the flood, yes. As a case in point, it is certainly traceable back as far as the 6th century BC, 7th century, where there was Confucius. You see, Confucius, although he was pragmatically seeking to promote good rulers, nevertheless believed that the ideal state would have been to have no government at all. But he was dealing with a situation where he couldn't obtain that. He was faced with an established and a corrupt rulership, and his very first step was to take aside those who found their leading role in society and try to get them to be socially virtuous. And he said, if you do this, the people will use you as role models and they will follow. Because, he said, if the leaders, the rulers, were honest, the people wouldn't steal even if you paid them to. Because you would set a fashion. One of the things that Alfred the Great did. There are other examples of anarchic principle can be drawn from history to show that it has been prevalent right down through all the years. It depends on the principle. Now you see, it was Brother Jolly that explained this principle to me in Brother Armstrong's home. He explained the actions of a certain very famous man, cultured man at that time, the peace-loving, peace-teaching pacifist philosopher Bertrand Russell, who led a column of peaceful demonstrators through the streets of London at that time. Bertrand Russell, the third Earl Russell, fellow of the Royal Society, brilliant mathematician, philosopher, author of many works on social development. His pacifism led him into imprisonment on one occasion, recognized worldwide as a humanitarian of a high standing, a man of peace and order. And I was astounded when Brother Jolly raised his eyebrows and said, "Brother, he's an anarchist." And he explained the matter to me in the hall of Brother Armstrong's home. And it was a lesson I never forgot. So now, thank you for your patience with that political diatribe, as it were. Let me return to a Bible student's interest in these things. Symbolic wind, earthquake, fire. Worldwide revolution, worldwide war, worldwide revolution, worldwide anarchy. Now in war we can recognize the features of the symbolic wind. We've had enough of it, we can reckon, we know what a war is. I went through one for 5 years, running around countries with a rifle in one hand and whatnot, before I came into the trade. In revolution, we see enough revolutions around in the world to be able to recognize analytically, because it's been analyzed for us through the media, what is going on. But are we as well informed on that word anarchy? They won't tell you about this because everybody fears it, which is what I've been saying, which is why the media have not explained these matters. Everybody's afraid of it. So are we inclined to take the common colloquial view of that world and assume that it only means that brainless kind of mayhem? Brother Johnson gives us our direction here. He tells us that God's permission of each of these three phases, war, revolution, and anarchy, has a number of purposes in connection with his most wonderful plan. And prominent among these purposes is his desire to teach mankind, in a very practical demonstration in which they will take part, that their confidence in these various human schemes for peace and prosperity is totally misplaced. That's what he is allowing to happen for. Now, for many centuries, Christendom's confidence was totally in a union of church and state, involving various hierarchies. Monarchy, aristocracy, landowners, capital, and so forth. Now then, judgment commenced with the world in 1914. Since 1914, we've had worldwide warfare, together with associated social, economic, and financial catastrophes, one after the other, with a growing media, with now in the epiphany, with a bright shining light to explain these things for the people, not to leave them in darkness. And this has to a large extent revealed the true nature of Christendom. Because Christendom was largely responsible for the outbreak and the nature of that war. And as a result, mankind's faith in those great institutions of Christendom has been greatly diminished, been undermined. So you see, the World War, has been a period of great education. As I said, this is a practical demonstration that God had given to the world, and that demonstration has resulted in their losing confidence in that, which God knew they would, which is why he permitted it. Now, the symbolic earthquake is gathering force, bringing increasing pressures upon those institutions, and we believe that this will continue to grow and grow and grow until it explodes by some little spark somewhere into the Armageddon phase of fighting, in which the worldwide revolution will make a wreckage of the whole of the Satan system. It won't get rid of it all. It'll make a wreck of it. It'll break down in pieces. And after this, we believe that yet another of mankind's vain theories will be put to the test. Because the belief of many that socialism can succeed where all these other political systems have failed will survive Armageddon, according to the prophecies. And it's for this reason, Brother Russell teaches, that after the Armageddon phase, God will permit socialist-type governments to rule over the people. And Brother Johnson further shows that the duration of this permission must allow sufficient time to demonstrate in the clearest possible way to the whole world of mankind. There must be time. Read your manner today, it's in there. So that socialism itself would come under the same hammer and show the people that there is no hope. Because they've tried it and it's failed. And they've watched it. The media has exposed it. They know the way it works. They know it's filled with corruption, as all man is filled. And it will be a great lesson to them. And it will pass away. Two great systems gone. And the collapse will be a very harrowing, trialsome experience for the suffering world. They don't know it, of course. But they're waiting for the manifestation of the sons of God. After this, we have the fire. Worldwide anarchy. Not the local, sporadic, incipient anarchy which is with us today, breaking out here and there, but worldwide anarchy. Question arises. Again, this is the nub of my argument. What type of anarchy will it be? Will it be the time of mindless mayhem that worldwide people would expect under anarchy, carnage, and so forth? Or will it be introduced originally as a logical scheme for living? A planned society with utopian promises of a better land. You get snatches of it coming out through Leo Tolstoy and his War and Peace. You get these ideas beginning to take shape. A planned society, in reality, another counterfeit kingdom. But this time preached by the exponents of a free society in anarchy. I believe that is what is coming. Undoubtedly the period will end in mayhem, because anarchy is the great destroyer that sweeps away the last vestiges of Satan's system. But if in the beginning we as Bible students are looking for the inception of this, we have to know what we're looking for. You see, there are many Bible students, deeply consecrated and so forth, haven't even seen yet that the time of trouble's on us. So don't think that you won't recognize anarchy when it begins. You won't, unless you know what you're looking for. Many will be left behind. It seems probable that at the moment time is being allowed for the effects of the worldwide war to work out its effects in society. Now we're looking world revolution in the face, and we understand that after Christendom falls, those socialistic type governments, antitypical Jehu and his sons, are given time in Europe. And people will have time to experience life under that failing socialistic system. And at that time, these people I'm talking about, the anarchists, will overthrow them and destroy them. And there may be a number of our Bible students alive at that time, and they need to know what they're looking for. That is antitypical Hasiel, who so attacks Jehu and his first son. His second and third sons, what happens, what they represent, who Antitypical Hazael and Ben-Hadad are has not yet been revealed. I have never read it through searches in the various different writings through the Epiphany and the Parousia. But the first two sons we know, and we know the Hazael that is active in the first reign, and the Hazael and Ben-Hadad who are active in the second reign. And we're talking about anarchists. We know that that anarchic principle is to be tried throughout the earth, to give the whole earth an experience of living under that system. And that experience will show that left without rulers of any kind, the fundamental, you know, laying the axe to the root, the very fundamental belief of the anarchist that good will come out if man is left alone will be shown to be wrong. And when man is no longer ruled, it will be evil that comes out, and prove the anarchist wrong by a practical demonstration, because of the evils that will result when every man has freedom to let run riot that which is evil in him through the fall, even if he hasn't got any more. They have to learn that lesson, that man was created upright, but now he's smitten by the fall. My chairman, what time should I finish? Thank you. Just coming up to the end. Now, this testing of the anarchic principle as a cure for society's ills couldn't be made in a world of mayhem. You don't learn anything in mayhem. But if you see people really trying to get a society going like that pantisocracy that breaks out in various parts of the world, where people get rid of the rulers and try to rule themselves according to their own interests, you can learn things. People really, from the heart, trying to do things. And it's failing. That's when you learn. But it could occur under a worldwide anarchic way of life, such as existed successfully, and mark this, from 1866 to 1936 in the Catalonian district of Spain. Few people know about this. They've pushed it out of history because, like all those anarchic things, and like Pastor Russell and other things that they don't like, the historians push it out. They don't want it there. But this is true history. I lived through it. I was in contact with it. In the Spain, first of all, for 150 years, Spain had been a main center of anarchic thought. It found roots there. And there was an anarchic society founded there that lasted successfully for 70 years. Now, what happened in 1936? I was 15 years old. Major importance. Old enough to understand. There was a weak socialist government in Spain, and it was foundering. It just couldn't keep things going. And having on the Catalonian plains in Spain, there was this anarchic society that had developed a way of having their life without rulers. They rejected this socialist government. They made their own rules. They were peaceful, they were prosperous, and so the socialists got enough trouble, it didn't bother them. But then, because they were foundering and it looked as if Spain was going to go into a deep economic depression, there was talk about the anarchists taking the country over. That was what went on under 1934, 1935, and 1936. Now, the reputation in Europe of anarchism, with its bomb throwing and so forth, was terrible. And the European nations, although avoiding open hostility with the anarchists, because you see, everything was very tense. They were running up to the World War, 1939. Everybody was afraid to say boo in case this war broke out. They nevertheless sought to subvert this anarchistic movement. And in 1936, when it looked as if it might happen, it took General Franco's fully equipped army of legionnaires, fully trained men, and he brought them over from over the Straits of Gibraltar from Morocco, and they landed in southern Spain. And together with him, there was Nazi and fascist aid, Nazi from Germany, Italians from the fascist world, and the collusion of virtually every other European nation, all got together to stop this thing from taking place in Spain. And it took all of them to defeat that dedicated but penniless and almost weaponless forces of the combined socialists and anarchist volunteers who were in Spain at that time. And all those people who believed that this was wrong joined what they call the International Brigade, and they went over, and it was a heroic brigade. Was that they fought virtually to the last man. They died in their thousands. It hardly any weapons, almost fighting with their bare hands. Some of my boyhood friends, like Jimmy Tatum, my friend at home, three of his elder brothers were killed in that war. Yes, I was acquainted with it, and the tears which followed. This was very, very real. I'm talking to you about a real historic situation. And so the anarchists were defeated there. They did battle for 3 years, from 1936 to 1939. And they were beaten out of existence. And after that, the World War. So the anarchists do have their heroes and their role models. And remember that they have a fully attested historic record, some of which I've just told you, of a practically applied and apparently successful anarchic way of life existing in civilized Europe for 70 years. So the anarchists, when they meet, talk about these things, and they are still waiting their historic opportunity to install this system worldwide. They're still there. They're waiting in the wings. And we understand from prophecy, 1 Kings 19, 11 and 12, that God sees them and is going to give them their opportunity in order that he might break their faith in those things. So that they with all the others will cry out, Lord, save us, and he'll send the Lord Jesus to show them how it should be done. My final comments, dear brethren. There will be time for the world to learn its lesson, and it's during the time of this downward plunging anarchy worldwide that we understand the prosperity of Israel. We'll be shining like a beacon in that world. I don't think you will ever get the Israelis to be anarchists. I don't think so. You'll be shining like a beacon among the economically crippled. Remember Brother Jolly said there would be few men left, quoting scripture. Economically crippled, morally devastated. I mean, we're only halfway down the slope, and look at the world. We think it's morally devastated now. Wait a little while and see what happens when mankind is free to let all of the evil come out. Then you'll see the true nature of evil. Then you will see why mankind will learn a lesson that will never, ever, ever, ever be forgotten. Such a time of trouble as never was before. The Lord isn't mincing his words. He's telling us straight. You expect this. You believe my word. You accept this. This is what he's saying. Disease-ridden, death-stricken, anarchic remnants of people that survive in those desperate times. And it will be easy to see and understand the envy and the bitterness of those disillusioned and fearful remnants of the peoples, once proud nations like this one, bringing them against that nation of Israel to fulfill the prophecies of the closing stages of this present evil world. And that experience will finally destroy any vestige of hope at all that mankind has in finding an acceptable way of life of any kind as that way of life has been recommended by humanity. Every last one has failed, and look at the situation. Leave them in universal despair. Read Brother Johnson, volume 17. This is the condition, my last words, in which we understand that world will be when they finally hear that still small voice, as it has it in the King James Version of 1 Kings 19 and 12. The voice that finally breathes on them in that version, our dear brother, guidance to their desired haven. Won't they be pleased? In Psalm 107 and verse 30, it summarizes it thus. Then they are glad, because they be quiet. Amen.
Thank our dear brother for his discourse. He's given us there a wonderful detailed description of anarchy, its gradual build-up and background to what we see today. And as Brother says, it's so important that really that we understand these things so that we can recognise that where we are in God's plan. And now, brethren, we've run a little bit over time. Brother has asked for the closing hymn of 151, Arise and Shine. If we can just take the first and the last verse.